It is Saturday, January 5th. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio. Today on Geek Speak, geek news, and in the second half, online learning with Code School. It's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, Bridges and Gaps Between Geek, Geeks, and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our show, we are going to be talking about learning to program and online learning in general with Adam from Code School. That'll be in the second half. The first half, we'll be doing geek news with, a little bit of geeks, the geek guests in the house in just a minute. And you're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a web instructor and world traveler. Hello, Ben.
How's it going?
Quite well.
It's been a while.
I know. I've missed you. Happy New Year.
Yeah. Well, I was able to do the show, and then you guys had too many geeks, and then you wanted me on the show, but then I was in, I think, New Orleans.
It's a disaster.
A cruise. And
will we see a lot of you this month?
Disaster. The cruise, right? That's fantastic. You should. I should be around.
I'm looking forward to it. And we have a geek guest as well, Adam Fortone. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, good. It all worked. Whenever we do Skype, my intensity level rises right before, but I'm glad it's working. I can hear you fine, so thank you for joining us. Adam is a programmer focused on Ruby on Rails, also JavaScript and front-end development in general, and works at Envy Labs, where they produce Code School. We'll be talking about that in the second half. And thank you, Adam, for joining us for the Geek News section as well.
Yeah, excited to be here.
Ben, tell us about the wonderful world of space.
Space. Okay, so as the regular listeners know, I have a bit of an obsession with exoplanets. I tend to talk about them all the time.
An exoplanet's a planet that's not in our solar system.
Exoplanet is a planet that is outside of our solar system, right? So all of our planets are, I don't know, what are they? Inoplanets? Or what's the opposite of exo? I don't know.
Planets.
Planets, yes. Anyway, we have a couple satellites and a couple telescopes that have been basically dedicating all of their time to looking for these exoplanets. And the question that's kind of on everyone's mind is, are we alone in the universe, right? Are there other planets out there that would potentially even be capable of supporting life? And as we've been looking, we've been finding a lot of planets around stars that are really humongous, like the size of Jupiter or the size of Neptune, that are very, very hot, very close to their sun. And that's all to be expected based on the way that we've been detecting these. But as Kepler is the main satellite that I'm going to be talking about right now, as it's been looking for exoplanets, it's been finding exoplanets that have longer orbital periods, that are further away from their stars. And of course, because they have longer orbital periods, it takes a little bit longer to detect them, right? I just want to give a really quick roundup because, I mean, after all, it is now 2013. So a quick roundup of the couple of years in exoplanets. We have a lot of exoplanets, like 15,847 as of just a couple days ago. And they released a list of potential habitable exoplanet candidates that were detected by Kepler. And I just want to say, of the potential habitable exoplanets, we've got 235 warm super Terrans, which are about our temperature, a little bit bigger than Earth. We've got 23 that are about the same size of Earth and about the same temperature. 23! And we've got 4 that are smaller than Earth and about the same size. So that would be within the quote-unquote habitable zone, as we call it. So that's really exciting. And
So what you're saying is Battlestar Galactica, that whole thing's going to happen. We're going to split up and... Okay, sorry.
I have a confession to make.
You haven't watched it?
No.
You were all excited about showing you the Star Trek thing over there.
Okay, well, that's a geek bit for later.
We'll talk about it later.
But yeah, I'm a Star Trek fan. I'm not a Babylon 5 fan or a Battlestar. But I do want to also mention...
Yes.
So they released this list, and they sorted it by this measure called Earth Similarity Index, which basically takes a bunch of these different qualities and ranks them, puts them all into one measurement. The qualities they look at are the class of planet, the habitable class of planet, the mass of the planet, the radius, the orbital period, and then the equilibrium and the main surface temperatures of these planets as well. And a lot of these are estimates, but the really cool thing is the top planet, the closest planet to Earth, has an ESI, an Earth Similarity
The closest
index.
Similarity. Closest in distance.
Yes, the closest in similarity has a similarity index of 0.97.
So it's a one like would be Earth.
Yes, one would be Earth.
One of the things they're just ignoring completely is atmosphere conditions. So because we don't know, right? We have nothing, no idea what's on it.
We can kind of make some guesstimates and things. I don't think they're looking at that here. But I mean, it's kind of amazing. Like we, over all of our history, we've been trying to convince ourselves that we're unique. First, all the heavenly bodies revolved around the Earth,
right,
and we
right.
were unique. And then, you know,
everything revolved around our sun. And then,
oh, of course, it was our sun.
Our
sun is cool. And then we found out that we're in this completely uninteresting portion of one of the arms of a galaxy. But at least it was our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. That's it. And then we discovered tons of more galaxies that are outside of our
galaxy. So we're not unique little flowers.
We're not at all unique, no. And this is just more evidence to show that we're just a random speck.
We've found, what, less than 1,000 exoplanets right now, right?
No. We've found 15,000.
15,000
exoplanets? I'm sorry. Let me qualify. Everything I just said, these are probably going to be confirmed. They're not officially confirmed exoplanets. They have to observe them for a long time to make sure it's not some fluke. But at the same time, all of the planets that I'm talking about, all of the potential exoplanets I'm talking about, have, assuming they're real, orbited three times or more.
Yeah.
So this isn't just like, oh, we saw a dip in the light output of a star, so it must be a planet in front of it. This is actually like, these are actually good candidates.
Right. And that's one of the things you have to know is its orbital time to determine its distance and its mass and all that. So
yeah, it's just incredible stuff.
Thank you, Ben, for the update on exoplanets. Always love it. I'm going to mention just a second. I saw a lovely quote by Simon Pegg. Simon Pegg's a performer. He actually in Star Trek Next Generation, most recent Star Trek movie, he played a character. Do you know who he played?
Simon Pegg. Who could he have played? This is not the one that was recently released, right?
Yes, the one that's recently released.
I mean,
recently, I don't know, 2 years ago.
He had a bit of an accent.
Yeah, Adam. Good. Adam knows.
Was it that Romulan guy?
No, Adam, who is it?
Oh, it's he played Scotty.
Yes, of course.
So Simon Pegg also done zombie movies, right? He's awesome. And he's got a book called Nerdy-Well, which is on my side bed table. I kept on meaning to read it so I could interview him because I think he's great. Uh-huh. But he has a quote this week, and I'm actually trying to collect these quotes. For years, I've asked people what they thought a geek was because of the radio show. I'm called a geek all the time, and that's what we do, right? And so I always have this long diatribe of what a geek is, and Simon Pegg's got one, so I thought I'd read it. Being a geek, this is Simon Pegg. Being a geek is all about being honest and about what you enjoy and not being afraid to demonstrate that affection. It means never having to play it cool about how much you like something. It's basically a license to proudly emote on some somewhat childish level rather than behave like a supposed adult. Being a geek is extremely liberating.
That's fantastic.
He's fantastic, right?
I love it.
So if you've got a geek quote of being a geek, that kind of celebration of embracing unknown and exciting and being excited about something, please feel free to let us know. We're geeks@geekspeak.org is our email address. And of course, you can find us up at geekspeak.org. Everything we talk about is up at geekspeak.org as well. In the house, we have Adam Fortuna. He's a developer and programmer and such at Envy Labs. We're going to be talking about Code School in the second half. So Adam, you got an interesting story going on.
Yeah, you're a geek, right?
Yeah, you're a geek, right?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, awesome. What's going on in the archaeology world?
Well, one interesting article I stumbled on this week was a discovery of these old wells, like old wooden wells in Germany from 7,000 years ago. And the thing that this like brings into question is that up until like just the last couple of weeks, it had always been assumed that certain metal tools like steel or tools like that were required to make these kinds of wells.
Oh.
And now it's kind of been discovered that these wells were made like way before that with stone tools instead. So it kind of it's bringing into question like our whole timeline for like when stone tools were used until when we were able to actually create things with wooden tools. So now the question is like how far back were we able to create like more complex things like wells or even buildings or something like that using stone tools before we made the switch.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, a well is really defined around the type of humanity that exists in that area, right? You've got nomadic people. You don't dig giant wells. I mean, that's a lot of work, and it's difficult to – I'm assuming they have to be maintained at some level. So very cool. So that whole idea of how the wells were made and therefore the time period of when people switched to the tool sets they used, new information about that. Very cool. Where's the – we'll link to this article up on geekspeak.org. Was there anything more you wanted to cover about that, Adam?
Oh, no. Yeah. That was just a really interesting article.
Awesome. See, this is the thing I found over the years of doing GeekSpeak, that when I invite somebody on to talk about, I don't know, online learning and learning to program and how to teach that, which is what we were talking about in the second half today, I realize that every one of these geeks that's kind of involved in technology loves just technology in general, which is great. I mean, we've always joked about, well, we all know a little bit of comic book history. We know a little bit about Star Trek or Star Wars or Battlestar Galactica or Babylon 5, right? Or Doctor Who. Like, all of us have one of those as that's our key, or we like all of them. But it's also that I didn't know what you're going to talk about, Adam, that you're interested in archaeology and discovering of time periods of human history and when they were digging wells. I love that geeks are interested in that stuff. Like, we're interested in everything, kind of.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something wrong with us.
maybe there's something right with us.
That's true. Beautifully said.
it feels like a celebration of knowledge to me.
Absolutely.
Know? Like, I don't know.
That's what I hope this show is all the time. Yeah. Ben, can you use your body for anything besides what you normally use it for? I'm trying to do a horrible segue into your next news story. Let's let it go and go ahead and start your next news story.
By any definition, yes or no.
If you're on a bridge and a train's coming, and you could save one person or five people by jumping off the bridge.
We're not doing morality.
All right, all right. I'm just thinking about using your body in strange ways.
Okay,
stopping a train.
But you could do that.
Your news story, sir.
My news story is there's a whole news story about just basically talking about harnessing heat from human bodies, and we're not talking about we're not talking about a Matrix kind of thing where human bodies are you know, used for however many BTUs of energy and da-da-da. Although that was a really interesting idea. In very cold places, it tends to be very cold, except in particular situations like, for example, the underground, right? The underground, you've got trains moving, you've got friction from the rails, and you also tend to have a lot of people clustered together in a very small area. And that means heat, a lot of heat. And so what do? I mean, you could just kind of let the heat be or, dissipate it, or you could try to capture it. And
I'd assume right now what you try to do is get it away so that people don't cook inside the tubes.
Well, I think generally people in places like Stockholm probably would like that, right?
Right.
Because it's warm. You can take off your jacket for a second, right? It turns out it can actually get up to 70 degrees. It's Fahrenheit. Which is pretty, thankfully not Celsius. 30 degrees Fahrenheit, that's actually pretty warm.
It's comfortable room temperature.
Yeah, very, very warm. That's like a spa almost. So it turns out, and I didn't realize this was possible, I thought, no way, you can't really capture heat that isn't really, really hot. You can't really capture like 70 degrees Fahrenheit, but it turns out you can, and it's a really simple system. All they do is they just run water through pipes, through the air, and it heats it ever so slightly, and then they pump it to the building next door, and they can actually heat the building next door inside.
So you're saying is
ever so slightly.
And what? Where are they doing this? Is it designed to do it? What tube system or what's underground?
Well, one of the places that they're talking about this article is Stockholm Central Station, and they have 250,000 railroad travelers a day.
Yeah,
and so they
have
actually.
You been to Stockholm?
I have not.
Okay, no. I haven't either. I don't know. See, that's the thing is, you know, Paris, the trains are called the metro.
Yeah.
New York, it's called
the
subway.
The subway.
London, it's the underground.
The underground.
Right.
Somewhere
they're all the same
else,
thing,
it's
of
the
course.
Tube.
Right.
And BART, it's the BART.
Right.
I don't know.
So in Stockholm, they're using body heat to
warm, basically the 13-story office building next door. It's 100 yards away.
That's awesome.
And so they're just pumping a bunch of water over there. The water heats up the floor, I think is what the way they're doing it. And then it's a very subtle heating effect, right?
Yeah.
It just kind of very slowly raises the temperature up to something more tolerable.
Cool.
It's kind of cool technology. And I didn't think about it because it's not very high tech. It's one of those really simple solutions. I was actually talking about with my housemate yesterday. We were trying to fix our heater, and we pulled off the little thing on the heater, And the way it can tell whether the heater should be on or off is just a very small magnet and a really long spring. And if the magnet gets close enough to the other magnet, then they click together and it completes a circuit.
Yeah.
And then if it gets cold enough, then the metal deforms enough to pull the magnet away. It's an incredibly simple solution. And we were talking about how computers are so complicated. Right. Like, there's so much complexity there. Why not just add a little bit more complexity to solve your problem? But when you're talking about things like heaters that don't have processing, like processors or anything like that inside, or if you're talking about 100 years ago, like, that I think is where the real genius was for solving problems, you know, finding the simplest solutions to difficult problems. So
some science clarity, room temperature is usually described as 20 degrees C or 68 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
So 70 degrees is not that much.
Not quite a spa, yeah. Actually.
Yeah,
I
it's kind of just warmish.
Yeah.
And of course, that's about 293 Kelvin. Just so for those people that need to know that stuff.
I only think in Kelvin.
And this is Geek Speak in the Air, and with me is Ben Jaffe and our geek guest, Adam Fortuna. And Adam, we're going to be talking about Code School, but let's go ahead and start talking about some of the challenges around what Code School does by a news story that you're interested in, Learn to Program. You want to talk about that article?
Yeah, this was a really amazing article written back in September by Brett Victor. It's written more like a thesis paper than like a news article, but he's kind of addressing the question, how do we get people to understand programming? Kind of the idea that programming's kind of a way of thinking rather than just a skill you learn little pieces of.
Yeah.
And he also kind of addresses it from the angle that people understand a problem if they can see it. So he's trying to make programming a much more visual medium for initially learning it.
Yeah.
So for instance, you want to do something like call a function in programming. So a function is just something that executes some code.
Mm-hmm.
Like he gives like amazing examples where as you are like hovering over the function name, it's explaining it, and maybe it's animating it in a timeline that allows you to see what that piece of code will do over time. It's really an insanely amazing article. We had discussions about this article for weeks at work, kind of trying to bring in some of the concepts into Code School and what we've been doing. So another great example he has would be something like, you want to draw a circle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the first parameter to a function to draw a circle is how big the circle should be. As a person who's never programmed before, you might not know that, you know, what you're passing in should be a number.
Right.
It needs to represent, let's say, the diameter of the circle.
In pixels or something, if we're using a screen, sure.
Right. So what if instead the interface that you're using to program gave you like a draggable way of scaling up and down,
yeah,
like that number without having to actually type it in, kind of a way to play with it before you even like hit execute or something.
What's that wonderful? What's that wonderful online space where you can do that kind of thing, where you can play with the code? It's like been implemented to some degree. Do you know where that is?
Are you not talking about JS Fiddle or JS Ben, right?
No, I'm talking about a place that's actually designed around teaching. It's not Khan. That's videos.
I think you are talking about Khan. In September they launched an online environment for this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Using JavaScript.
Yeah, we covered it on Geekspeak. I'm trying to find the actual page. So Khan Academy's got this wonderful resource of information about learning. The article you're talking about, who was it written by?
Brett Victor.
Okay, from Khan, right? He's involved to some degree.
He's not from Khan, but okay. They cited a lot of his initial work as some of their inspiration for their course that you're talking about too.
Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, we'll find the link and everything. But it's a wonderful way to here's using math expressions tutorials, and they are using So they're using actually processing library. In the browser. So processing is this IDE that traditionally was Java-based, and now it's JavaScript-based. And it's one of those recommendations I get to parents who want their kids to learn how to program, I say go to processing.org, download that tool, run on your computer, open up the examples, and play with them. And that's a few steps away, right? And you got to install something. You got to have Java running. So if you're on a Windows machine, you got to make sure your Java's up to date. It's a few steps that are kind of problematic.
Yeah, not fun for a non-geek.
No, in the last few years, though, the processing library has been ported over to JavaScript. And so now it's actually quite easy to do a lot of it in browser. And that's what Khan's doing, the Khan Academy is doing. We covered this a while ago on GeekSpeak. But I agree. Let's get back to the article in general that you're quoting, Adam. I'm assuming that you guys at Code School have had a lot of discussions about this basic idea of how to teach people about programming who've never done it or thought that way. Have you come up with any gems, you think?
A lot of it's just constant feedback.
Mm-hmm.
We recently launched a course on SAS. It's it's kind of like CSS. It's a way of styling HTML. And so, for instance, on something like that, we try to give as instant feedback as we can. So even before you hit submit, just as you're changing the code, it's re-rendering it in another frame, and it's kind of adding another layer on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, you're choosing colors in code. Like, you might have, $EEEEEEE, and as someone just looking at that, you don't know what that color is. So, for instance, in the rendered part, you might be able to hover over that and see what color that translates to.
Right.
So, like, just from little things like that to kind of
bridge the gap from constant feedback to
a clear image.
That is one of those things that happens, especially when you're programming. You have this kind of imagination of what's going on in the application you're writing in your mind. And oddly, as you get better and better at programming, the language you're using is the way that visualization occurs. So we call them programming languages because that's what they are. I mean, they are a language. Just like if I were to communicate with Ben right now in a different language other than English, if you didn't understand that language, it'd be hard to understand the ideas. A programming language is really defined around that concept. You are thinking a certain way. And of course, we have a lot of English around how we're thinking. But when I use the term a closure for a programmer, and especially JavaScript programmers, we all understand what we're talking about there. And so if I talk to somebody that's not a JavaScript programmer and I use the term closure, I then have to describe that state. I have to translate it into English, which is actually kind of a long translation. In fact, a lot of learning programming is about translating into English so the person understands the idea and teaching the language. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of ways to learn. If you're just talking about another language like German or Italian or whatever, there are a lot of different ways to learn those languages and a lot of different services out there, and those services have taken different approaches. And traditionally, the way I would learn Italian, for example, would be I would learn a word in Italian, I would learn what that word is in English, right? But there are other services, I can't remember... Rosetta Stone, I think, is one of them that doesn't. It's language agnostic, so it'll show you a picture of a teacup, and then it'll tell you the word in the language you're learning for teacup. So you don't go through English.
Right.
And same thing with. I think it's very similar with programming. If you can learn programming directly, concepts directly into the programming language, you're going to be a lot better off than if you have to translate through English because it's just clunky.
Well, okay, how? The way I learned to program, I think, was by copying other code and modifying it a bit. This is basic days. I'm a VIC 20, right?
Yeah.
I'm copying their example stuff and then playing with it till it changes with a lot of patience because, we didn't have any static memory, right? So every time you turn on the computer, it was completely clean. You had to start from scratch. Yeah. But in doing that, I think that that's very much like immersive learning.
It's the same thing as we're doing now. As far as I can tell, all we're talking about is tightening up the feedback loops, right? So when you were learning, you would make some changes, and then you would go through all these steps to see your results. And it was a very long feedback loop. But then again, also, 20, 30 years ago, we had a lot more patience for that. We were a lot, the things were a lot slower.
Not society just narrowly, but us. We were younger.
Well,
we had more time.
Us and also society. I mean, think about it. If you want to listen to a piece of music, you had to rummage through for the record. and now we just open. I mean, we could just search for it.
If I can't find a song in 30 seconds, I won't listen to it.
I don't know about
any
it anymore,
song on the planet.
Yeah. So we have a lack of patience, and so in order to learn things, we need to tighten up those feedback loops, and that's actually exactly what you were talking about, Adam. Is if you want to figure out what that color E E E E E E is, if you hover over it and you can just bam see it,
right?
it's easy. But if you have to go through a couple steps to figure out what the color is, it's a longer process. You lose interest more quickly. And especially today, with people being so having such short attention spans, that means you don't learn. So
I got to say, Ben, that I remember when I first was teaching people CSS, the difference between CSS and HTML, you know, table, cell, padding, oh gosh. And I was going to CSS. When I was doing that teaching, I was using Photoshop at the same time. It was actually kind of necessary because when I talked about what color you wanted, I'd say, well, go to Photoshop, open the color wheel, and you got to turn on, turn on RGB web view, I think is what they called it, that, something like that, right? And then grab the hexadecimal string. That's the color. And so now, of course, it's built into most of the tools. Yeah. And that's both for our own convenience, but also for a learning thing, it's much better.
But
Adam,
know,
we're kind of we haven't let you talk much, so sorry.
Oh, that's okay. But I agree completely with the concept of the loop. The faster you get feedback, the faster you can like kind of take in the entire concept that you've been presented with. Yeah, that's something that we try to do a lot because we like Code School is based around like little in-browser challenges that should only take you, you know, a minute or two to do.
Each challenge.
Right, each challenge. So you might watch a video and then take a couple of these little challenges. And so each one you'll submit it, and then you'll probably get some kind of feedback back. Maybe that's in the case of a JavaScript course, you might have it execute in a little window and see it. And we're slowly guiding you towards that. So if you submit it and you have a bug in your code, we'll come back with some error saying like, oh, you didn't add a semicolon on line 4, or maybe you didn't set the height to, you know, 10 pixels or something like that.
Yeah.
We'll push you towards the next place we want you to be.
Right. We'll talk more about Code School in just a little bit. I definitely want to describe it well. In fact, maybe we should just start describing that now because I think that the show format's changing a little bit right now for Geek Speak, and so we're doing things a little differently than I normally do them. So let's go ahead and move forward with Code School. So Code School by Envy Labs. Now, Envy Labs is a group of, I guess, kind of a Ruby user group a few years ago got together in Orlando, Florida, and everyone was like, yeah, let's start working together. Envy Labs gets created. Everybody gets hired. You work for Envy Labs probably 2 years now or so. And the Code School project coming out of it is basically an online learning space for learning to program and basically having the skill sets to participate in the open source programming environment that's around. It's hard to kind of define this space, but you could say GitHub.com is a good area to describe that, right? A lot of people use GitHub, but the open source environments of Node and of Ruby on Rails and JavaScript in general, scripting, modifying your command line, learning Git, all that happens around GitHub, and that kind of community, to join in that community, if you don't know much about it, Code School is one way to do that, in the sense that it's a paid for service, you have videos and just demonstrations, and it's kind of unique in the way it works. So I went ahead and did the Try Git, which is a free class anybody can do, and I recommend, if I've talked about Git before, it's source control, it's kind of different, but if you go to Code School, if you go to geekspeak.org and click on the Code School link and give it a shot, you can sign up for the Git class and start walking through. What I found in doing this, and Ben, I recommend you go ahead and open it up just so you can see what it's like.
Code School?
Yeah, go to geekspeak.org and click on the Code School link. And the class, it's like a game. It feels like a game. It's got like levels and challenges, and as you go through, you get badges. It's very gamified. Would you say, Adam?
Yeah, definitely. There's each level you complete, you get a badge, and then each course you complete, you get like a course completion badge.
And are you providing these badge feeds for like websites? Because one thing I want to do is, since I passed one of those classes, I want to go ahead and put it on my website.
We've talked about it. We don't have something for that. There is an API. So someone actually created like a third party like JavaScript add-on that hits your, we call it a report card, where it shows like every course you've completed and fetches those. So someone made something that like lets you add all your badges to your web page if you want.
Cool. Yeah, I was assuming that would be something you do. I'll have to look for that that sample. So describe to me, you sign up for a class and you start doing it. Describe what it's like.
So it varies based on the course, but for the vast majority of them, you're probably wanting to learn a specific skill. So like we recently launched one for learning iOS programming in the browser that we did crazy Kickstarter campaign for and launched it. And so to learn iOS, you would start the course, you'd watch a little video. I think it's probably around 5 minutes. And then immediately after that, you'd be faced with a code editor and a problem. And it would start out slow, something probably you only need to edit like 2 or 3 lines, and then you hit submit. And behind the scenes, we would, in the case of the iOS course, we'd like execute your code, and then we show you like an iOS simulator in the browser that you can like click and drag and pretend just like it's an iPhone. And
Okay, so you're not actually going to be developing any code with this, in the sense that it's not going to allow you to program an app or something. But it does use an iPhone as an emulation, so that you can kind of see if you had done this in the full development stack of iOS, you would have gotten an application that did this.
Exactly.
Well, let's see. Let's see if we can play a little video from that course you just mentioned. What the heck? So it's
Hello, I'm Greg Pollack, and you're watching Level 1 of Try iOS. You're going to need to know a little bit of Objective-C to get through this tutorial. If you haven't seen Objective-C before, see the Objective-C primer, which you should find a link below this video. Once you've done that, come back, and we'll get going.
Let me skip.
And
skip
levers and instrumentation. Yeah. Well, we wouldn't be diving for a long time, because there's a...
So, the thing that's interesting, of course, is that this course then goes into an analogy about submarines. And trying to describe the complexity of programming and how to get from where you need to be at a zero point to a place where things are working.
That's one of the hard parts about some of these courses is kind of trying to narrow down what prerequisites should be.
You know, Adam, can I have you just say that all again? I think that I was stealing bandwidth while playing that video. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's one of the hard parts about like any kind of teaching is just narrowing down the prerequisites and kind of assuming like what the base skill set should be for someone. Like someone getting into jQuery, for instance, should you assume that they know HTML and CSS? Should you assume that they know some basic programmer constructs like what's a variable, what's an if statement? So kind of like abstracting all that and deciding if you want to teach it or whether you want to put it off into another document that kind of brings them up to date like we did in the iOS course is a kind of a problem we have to think about for each subject we teach.
That's a difficult problem too, because if you do decide to address some of the more basic topics in one of the more advanced classes just to bring people who don't know it up to date, then the more advanced users might get bored and then you'll lose them, whereas vice versa.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's an interesting line to walk.
I'm speaking with Adam Fortuna of Envy Labs about Code School, a place that you can learn how to program. I also have in the air with me is Ben Jaffe. My name is Lyle Troxel. Our producer is Rick Philman. You're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP. Ben, you got a geek bit today?
I do, and I'm holding it right here. Can everyone see this? Oh, wait a second. We're on the radio. Do you want to try and describe this?
It kind of looks like a twisted Klingon. Gosh, what is that called? Batleth.
It doesn't look anything like
Adam,
a batleth.
Adam, did you know what that was?
Yeah, I think it looked kind of like a Klingon batleth.
But it also looks like a giant S with, it's made of blue plastic. It's got nubbins sticking out of it. It's about half the height of a human being.
Yeah, that pretty much describes it. This is one of the coolest things I found all year. just talking about the whole, you know, year and geekiness roundup. It's a little back massager. And the thing I find so interesting about it is, again, its simplicity, right? But yet how much you can do with it, right? All these little nubbins on this piece of blue plastic, you know, that's shaped like an S. You know, you can push forward and put pressure on any point in your back. It's really, really interesting.
So you hook this S thing over your shoulder and stick one of those little round nubbins into your back. And then you push forward with your arms and that little nubbin gets that spot. Okay, hand it over.
Yeah, okay.
Now my back starts hurting.
Yeah, you might have to.
As someone who's broken their spine. I hope I don't do so right away.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fantastic.
Yeah, because you can reach anywhere in your back. It's incredible. It's just
feeling
incredible.
A little out of it, feeling like you're hearing something you need to be seeing, that's actually true. Geek bits are, of course, a little bit of technology we like that you have to see. Normally it's videos, but today it's an object. And Ben, you're going to post pictures of these objects on GeekSpeak before we leave the studio today.
I will. Awesome. And I don't want to endorse a particular company that sells it.
Oh, there's probably lots of them.
But if you search for, you know, self-massager, you'll get that.
So this isn't yours? You're not going to get a kickback for this?
No.
I wish we made money on GeekSpeak, but we're volunteers. I think we're suckers.
Well, I don't know. It'd be nice to supplement fuel costs to get to the station.
I think the company that has these should send me one. They're fantastic.
I think they should send me another one.
Maybe we'll just pay for them. Thank you, Ben, for the geek bit. All right,
give it back.
Oh, darn it. What the heck is it called, Ben? You don't know what it's called?
I don't know.
But you're going to find a link to it so people can get one and know about it.
I just call it that weird S-shaped blue thing. Like... Hey, can you hit me that?
The company might need more marketing, like a name on the product.
Well, okay, so this particular product is called Body Back Buddy, which... You know, they always have these crazy names.
You knew what the name was, you just didn't want to say it
actually,
on air.
Actually, I didn't want to say it on air, but I didn't know.
Of course, we don't endorse stuff on GeekSpeak. In fact, I don't endorse... KOSP does not endorse Code School. I happen to think it's really cool and I like it. And I got to say, it's a paid for product. We rarely do that. I mean, we're a public radio. So one of the things we do is non-commercial. So when we talk about a product, like we're talking about Code School today with Adam Fortin, it feels a little weird because I shouldn't mention the price of it, though it's kind of expensive in my mind. And in fact, that's one of the things that's a little off-putting to me. How many people are working on this project, Adam?
I think probably about 10 to 15 at a time. Usually, like, because Envy Labs is a little bit bigger, like 30 people. We kind of just bring in people as needed.
And I noticed that there's a lot, and the videos normally has a few, you know, it's a few people that are doing the videos. So you have kind of the performer aspect, actor / coder who's teaching the class is on video all the time. And then there's also these like screen demos that you give away as well, kind of like a video feed of screen demonstrations. And are all these people paid?
So we have some courses that are free, like the one you talked about earlier, Try Git. Like that's a course anyone can take. You don't even need to sign up for Code School. And we have a couple other courses like that. One of them is called Try Ruby. So it's a way to try the Ruby programming language in the browser, and it guides you through, assuming you haven't done anything with Ruby before.
So
we have one like that for jQuery called jQuery Air, which we're currently redoing and bringing up to the latest jQuery, things like that. And then there are some more advanced ones. So like you want to learn Ruby on Rails, you might take Rails for Zombies, which is a free course for learning Rails. But then if you wanted to continue your education, then you could sign up and take a paid course at Code School.
Now,
so
Rails,
we try to give out the free ones as the first level ones.
Can you describe Rails for Zombies?
So,
it's
another course that has videos and code challenges for learning Ruby on Rails, which is this framework for building web applications. And it's themed around kind of a zombie invasion. So all of the objects in this world that we're building are zombie related,
and fantastic.
A lot of it ties into like Evil Dead themes or Walking Dead themes. We try to just keep it fun like that.
You know, zombies are an incredible way to get people to pay attention to you.
We use science.
CDC did we talk about this?
Yeah, years ago.
It was just this last year. Oh. They released the guide to the zombie apocalypse. But really, it was just a way to get people to read what they should do in case of a disaster.
Right.
But
have
everybody
water on hand,
read it.
Have food
and thought,
on it. Right, right.
How cool is the CDC?
So, Adam, for Rails for Zombies, when you succeed or fail at a challenge, do the zombies get closer, or do you defeat them, or is it not that much like a game?
Not that much like a game. I think you get badges for like at the end of a chapter for, you know, defeating that level of zombies. But other than that, it's more just the theme of the course.
So it's interesting, Lyle, that you say that it's expensive. Because if you look at, say, a university that you go to, that's exorbitant compared this. I mean, this is well under $100 a month.
Well, it's $25 a month. I think you get access to everything up there at that price. So from the perspective of a college or something, it's extremely cheap. I think that the community college that I went to years ago was, you know, $85 a unit. Yeah. So, but then again,
which is expensive. And then again, that was somewhere like UC Santa Cruz or one of the UCs, right, or one of the bigger colleges. I mean,
$40,000 a quarter.
That's insane.
Year. Yeah. It's crazy. It's
so
crazy.
So we're talking about two orders of magnitude of difference. So in a way, it's extremely cheap, but in a way, it's also expensive because there are also a lot of free options out there. So it's kind of an interesting question. Yeah. Also, for whatever reason, employers really put a lot of stock in that piece of paper you get at the end of four-year college, you know, whereas services like this can't provide that.
Yeah, so, I got to say, though, as a self-taught programmer, I think I took one class in college, and I don't have a bachelor's degree. You know, I mm-hmm. got out of school kind of early, unfortunately. I don't have formal computer science training. But mm-hmm. at this point in my life, I know quite a bit about computer science, of course.
You know what my major was, right?
Theater, right?
Yeah, my major was theater. And here I am doing nothing with theater.
You're coding only, right?
Coding, and I'm teaching coding. So.
Well, Ben, what I want you to do this week is go ahead and try one of these free code school things just to see what it's like, because it's definitely fun. Like the jQuery one, you don't have to necessarily watch the videos, though they're well produced. That's how I did. I kind of jumped through because I wanted to finish the badge because I started a while ago with the video. And I'm like, oh, it's not done. I should at least finish one. And so I just jumped through the jQuery one because, of course,
that's how
if you're a jQuery
you.
Programmer, not a problem to step through the challenge without even watching the videos. But the videos are actually quite good in demonstration. It's like a class session. To some degree. So, Adam, you're doing a lot of the coding at Code School, and I'm curious about the actual code. Are these Ruby on Rails applications?
Yeah, right now, like, the main Code School course is one site, and then each course is its own, like, separate entity that just runs separately. And so I'm usually working on, like, the courses we put out, because we put out generally one a month, and then we try to put out a free course every couple months.
Yeah, okay, that's pretty good. So if you're a regular subscriber, I guess, you keep paying it every month, you're going to get a new course every month. And of course, was I right at that whole price point? If you sign in, you actually have access to all of them. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so that's a pretty good rate, and especially if you can have a company pay for it and do it. But what I was going to say about self-training stuff is that as I learned programming, as I jumped into web development like before 2.0, or before web 2.0 with the boom, I was realizing that anybody could spend a month learning to do, I think at the time was PHP, and make a living. Like it's not, mm-hmm. and then in doing that and trying to interact with people around that, I realized how actually hard it is to get someone who doesn't know anything about programming to a place where they could be a programmer. That is actually not about the PHP language, if you will, which, you know, PHP.net is awesome at telling you all about the language. Like it's easy to learn it to some degree, but it's actually about that first hurdle. And that's the question I've got for you. A lot of these, Adam, look like, like even in the free iOS, you know, start learning how to program iOS, it says you got to know some C#. I'm sorry, not C#. that wouldn't make sense. Objective C. And do you find that you've got a method to serve someone who has passed algebra in high school, but that's the extent of their programming knowledge, if you will?
I would say that's probably not the student level that excuse me. That we'd probably be targeting. We're kind of targeting more people that have maybe taken like a programming class in college and then, or maybe even high school. And then this would be their point that they could go into after that. So it's not the very, very basic intro in most cases, but it could be the next step for like real world use of that knowledge.
Right. Very cool. Okay, so you said that each one of these classes is actually a different web app, website. Are they all Ruby on Rails built?
Yeah, all of them are Ruby on Rails.
Okay, interesting. So you got the introduction to Node. I can't remember what that one's called, but that one's done on Ruby on Rails. You're not using the Node stack and Jasmine or something like that? Not Jasmine, sorry, whatever the, I can't remember what the light frameworks on top of Node to make it more Rails-like.
Like Express or something.
Express,
like
thank
that.
You. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. The front end that you actually hit is pretty much all the same for all of them. Mm-hmm. But then, like behind the scenes, when you enter some code in the browser, we're running that code in some way behind the scenes. So for like the Node course, we might run it with Node.js or something behind the scenes. But with Ruby, we might run it in like a Ruby or a Java Ruby, JRuby environment. So it depends on the course a bit.
So what you're saying is in the course, you're not building an entire new interpreter for the language. You're going ahead and using an existing one and seeing what the output is.
Right.
I think that makes a lot more sense. I was thinking about that when I was doing the jQuery one, that you're asking me to do a certain thing, but it looked like you were really just comparing the final result of the page content with what you expect. So I could have done it any way I wanted to in jQuery.
Yeah, I think for that one, you can do it wherever you want.
So you also have one, then I want to talk briefly about this. You've got Rails testing for zombies, and this whole zombie motif goes through the Rails learning schedule. And one of the things about testing that I find really fascinating is trying to describe it to people that aren't programmers, what the idea of test-driven development is. Can you try that?
Do you do
test-driven development on these classes? I mean, in a sense, when you're programming these websites to do these code things, are you using test-driven development to do so?
For instance, if we're, like, let's say we're writing a challenge that's presented to the user, like a try to find a zombie with an ID of one. Like, we'll look at solving that problem from a test-driven development standpoint. Like, what if they enter nothing? What should their response be? And then we write the code. We write what their response should be in a test, and then we go implement that so that when they enter, you know, nothing, they get a nice response like, you know, you did not call the find method on the zombie object.
Right.
And that's kind of a test-driven approach. Like that's the definition of a test-driven approach. You write the test first, and then you go and implement the code to make it happen.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of tests that you have to set up are about user input, and of course, your entire application is about the user is going to try a lot of things and going to be wrong sometimes and right sometimes. So it's all about what kind of feedback you can give back to the person. That's really cool. So can you try to describe test? Well, let me this. What are the current exciting areas at Code School? What are you guys all excited about doing next or taking and continuing?
One of the things we're pretty excited about is two of the last courses we put out, Try iOS, and we put out one called Try R. There's this R programming language, which is used by statisticians and people for modeling like large bits of data. It's a really interesting language. There's a free course on it. And for those two courses, we kind of changed our course structure a bit. So instead of having like one video and then a whole lot of challenges, we're able to kind of tweak how we're presenting it. So you might watch a video, then you might have a code challenge, and then you might have maybe something where you just have to like a demo of the product, like jQuery, for instance. Mm-hmm. There might be an entire page where all you do is mess around with jQuery and learn what it can do. And then there might be another one that's a video, and then... So it kind of changes up what we're able to teach. And a lot of it was inspired by that learnable programming article talked about earlier.
So what you're saying is you've actually taken Brent Victor's ideas about learnable programming that of course it is implemented on Khan Academy at some level, and you started incorporating it into your classes. So as you go along, one of the steps would be play for 10 minutes on figuring out how to do things. And when you've done some stuff, go to the next page.
Right.
Kind of giving people an in-browser, I don't know, what is that called? I guess a sandbox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And in one of the courses that we're actually putting out in cooperation with Google about Chrome DevTools. So it's like learning how to use the developer tools that Chrome provides, the Chrome web browser.
Mm-hmm.
And so for something like that, a challenge might be bringing up the Chrome web inspector and like changing the title of the page to be something new.
Oh, so they'd actually be using the Chrome DevTools. They wouldn't be using your page exactly. Your page would just be looking at the content. Oh, that's cool.
That is fantastic.
That's awesome.
Those are the tools that at least I as a web developer use all the time.
Yeah,
and I've never seen any real...
Well, there's some great video demonstrations on Google. You know, if you watch the Google feeds of like demonstrations, and I'm always like, wait, you can do that?
Yeah,
you can save the output CSS easily.
If anyone really enjoys the Chrome DevTools, look up pretty much anything Paul Irish is recording about. That guy rocks.
So is Paul Irish going to be doing your class?
He actually helped on writing it.
So. Yeah, cool.
Oh, very cool.
Now, let me ask you this: if Google is doing this with you, is Google paying for it, and therefore it's going to be one of these freer classes?
Yeah, it's going to be a free course.
Yeah, that's awesome.
try-get was for that. That was like our course that we did in cooperation with GitHub.
Yeah,
this is going to be our one in cooperation with Google.
Yeah, you could tell that it was part of the GitHub connection because, of course, part of the class is actually creating a GitHub account and syncing with it. So awesome. I'm actually running out of time, so I need to do this real quick. Oh, I think we're actually doing perfect. Oh, good. So you can learn more about Adam Fortuna's project, well, the project at Envy Labs, by going to geekspeak.org and just click on Code School. You'll learn about that. And, of course, I'll have some links about everything we talked about today. Adam Fortuna, thank you so much for joining us on Geekspeak today. Really awesome of you to talk to us about, well, about archaeology and about programming. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Adam Fortuna is, of course, a programmer and developer and teacher. Helps make Code School happen, which is an online learning place to learn to program. Ben Jaffe also is in the air with me. Ben, thank you so much for being here.
Celebrating 40 years together, this is 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, streaming and podcasting at kosp.org.